Tillamook Chocolate Collection ice cream is a total chocolate game changer. We start with unbelievably creamy dark chocolate ice cream. Then we add different chocolate treats, like chocolate cookies, chocolate cake, or chocolate brownies, to make four decadent chocolate flavors. Because sometimes the thing that pairs best with chocolate is more chocolate. Tillamook Chocolate Collection ice cream. Extraordinary dairy.
And we're back with an all-new episode of Keep It. I'm Ira Madison III.
I'm Louis Fertel, and I'm priming myself this episode because when we express even 1% of 1% of a negative take, I'm just preparing for my information, my social security, my address to be on the internet, and we are talking about Taylor Swift, so God be with us. I think God has abandoned this conversation altogether, actually. So God's, wherever you were, thanks for playing.
Well, God's not on this album.
No. Everybody else is, though.
The Tortured Poets Department is the new Taylor album. And of course, she also released the anthology, her third time dropping basically a second album later in the evening. She loves to keep them Swifties awake.
I fucking guess, yeah. Meth one.
It's giving Nightmare on Elm Street, okay?
Dream Warrior, Taylor Swift.
If Swifties don't wake up with a new album at 3 a.m., they won't wake up at all.
Right. I have to say, I always respect, though, when she does her little, like, promotional weirdo gambit where, like, there's more songs than you thought or whatever, it is always a surprise. Like, because what she does in terms of releases is always so different than other artists, there's always an element of surprise there. It's actually always more surprising than what the music turns out to be usually. So I have to applaud the marketing.
Well, I mean, listen, like I said before, she's always taunting Gotham City, like the Riddler, with all these weird codes and things and how she promos it. And then, of course, there's other drops in the night. Like, you got to beat Batman.
Right, right. Precisely.
It is interesting you bring up, like, the promotion thing specifically because, of course, the number one diva in the game who changed promotion in terms of music was, of course, Beyonce, you know, dropping self-titled on a Thursday night, and it sort of changed, you know, the music industry to where songs and albums come out on Friday, right?
We're not obeying the rules of the Billboard Albums chart where it's most optimal to release on Tuesday because then the numbers come out the next week, yeah.
Right, and so it is interesting that Taylor has also managed to create sort of her own ecosystem of how she releases things as well.
Right. No, she's her own music industry. You can basically be a fan of Taylor Swift, and that can be your entire musical diet now, and you've never heard of anything else. I don't recommend that, but I'm just saying it can happen.
I mean, SNL should really redo that Beyoncé sketch about the Swifties, and maybe they will.
Yeah. I don't think we're done with that world of intrigue yet.
Yeah, honestly, getting into this episode, I feel like you could kind of make an anthology of our discussions of her albums because we've done this show for over 6 years now. And so it is interesting. Every time we get to a different Taylor album, the discussion that surrounds it, and our last one, of course, was Midnights, which I described personally as, I thought it was a fine album. I've grown to kind of dislike it more as time has gone on, but I called it non-essential.
Yeah.
I think that there were some songs that I enjoyed when it came out, particularly the 3 a.m. tracks, and I enjoyed Lavender Haze quite a bit. I've never liked Antihero, to be honest. And I think that as time has gone on, I haven't even picked up other songs, because, you know, sometimes that'll happen when you sort of don't like an album. Right away. And then a couple years later or so, oh, I actually do listen to a couple songs on this. They've grown on me. Nothing has grown on me.
That's what I was just saying about the Kacey Musgraves album that just came out. I thought I just totally didn't like it at first. And now, like, Cardinal, I'm like, oh, that's the 70s I want to hear. And Jade Green has a tizzy about it, like a light, leafy, tizzy thing going on that I've now acquired. But that didn't happen to me at first. And actually, a similar story for me is this album, which we'll get into momentarily.
Yeah, but Midnights has not grown on me whatsoever. This, I will say, probably a little bit similar to your Kacey Musgraves thing. This album has been sticking with me a bit more than I expected, but we're going to get into the entirety of the Tortured Poets Department this episode. And then we are also going to talk to the fantastic Juliana Canfield, who is starring in Stereophonic on Broadway, the sensation that just hit Broadway right now. And it is a play about a Fleetwood Mac-esque band recording an album in the 70s. And what is supposed to be a one-month recording process becomes a years-long recording process because their album keeps going up in the Billboard charts, and they keep getting more money from Columbia to record the album. In the play, they even reference that this album has a bigger budget than Pink Floyd did on their album.
Right. So it's interesting. First of all, when you read about Stereophonic, the play, almost all the actors in this play had no musical experience beforehand. They were like trained and coaxed into being these sensational superstardom evoking performers. So that's just amazing too. But also recently I've become reobsessed with the Mamas and the Papas, you know, the folk band of the 60s.
You've been posting a lot of Cass.
Yes. Yeah. Cass always one of my favorite vocalists, but I'm really into her right now. And I learned recently that one of their last albums, they have a song that's not one of their best at all called For the Love of Ivy. And by the time that album had come out, they spent a month just on the vocals for that song, for a song you don't even care about. So I'm thinking about that, like the hell of just being stuck in a recording booth trying to get something right, even when it doesn't turn into like one of your essential hits. You know, not every album turns into Rumors. Most albums don't turn into Rumors.
Yeah, and it's also so interesting watching this play. I saw it last night at the Golden Theater. It was my second time seeing it because I saw it at Playwrights Horizon as well when it was off Broadway. So much of the tension in recording an album like that during that time period is also, you got to get it right. It's being released on vinyl back then, so you also need a certain amount of songs, and you also can't go over a certain amount of songs. Like, there is a time limit. So it was funny watching this, living in the era of the Tortured Poets Department, which has 31 fucking songs on it now.
No, she just backs up another truck, and you're, like, covered in songs again.
Meanwhile, in Stereophonic, as would have happened with Fleetwood Mac, as would have happened with the Mamas and the Papas and everyone else making music around this time, it's debates about what are we cutting, because it's not all going to fit on this album. And it's, if you don't have enough for a double album, then you got to cut a bunch of shit.
I'm having now flashbacks to being an editor at the newspaper in the University of Iowa.
Where, oh, God.
You're down 2 inches of space. I remember, I'm sorry, I'm going to put somebody on blast right now. My co-editor, Jenna, a lovely writer, Jenna Sauer, she worked for Jezebel for a while. She came in with like an 86-inch story, and it was supposed to be 20. And I'm just sitting there, like, imagine All the President's Men, except Jason Robards is just crying to himself like a faggot. That's me. That was me at the table trying to figure this out. And I imagine cutting albums was similar. You have this many inches of space, literally.
Not you unlocking that evil memory for me of high school and college newspapers. I was the entertainment editor at our high school paper. And of course, my friend Andy Behrens, who was the editor-in-chief at the time, was always like, if you do not edit these things down. I had a column too, and it was always cutting out words to make things fit. And
there's going to be no adverbs in this by the time we're done. Trust me. Yeah.
Now who gives a fuck?
Right. No,
just
please.
Throw it online.
Have AI do the other half of it. Yeah.
All right. So when we're back, we're going to get into this album. You know we love to support the non-binary community, and you know we also love wordplay. So, of course, we have a new tea in the Cricut store that does both. They, thems, the rules.
It's a tea based off a segment on Love It or Leave It, and it's been a highly requested merch item. Now it's finally here. Head to crooked.com/store to pick up a shirt.
Swifties can finally put down their Kodaks because the album is here, and you can also put down your guns.
We come in peace.
The Tortured Poets Department dropped Friday night, And then dropped again at 2 a.m. with 15 more tracks.
Yeah, going up to 31 tracks. I will say this about the album to start. I think I had the same initial reaction a lot of people did, which was, this is her worst album and these songs all sound the same. I was surprised upon further listens that it does have some legs, and songs that you thought kind of didn't have hooks actually had seeped into your brain a little bit. So it's sort of rising in my estimation, but at the same time, this is, I think, one of her lower rated albums in recent history. Like, Pitchfork gave it something in the sixth zone. Metacritic is just not as high as her previous albums.
Pace Magazine did a drive-by.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. They straight up said, that's the end of her. She's covered in paste.
And then took off the byline.
Yeah,
because, of course, there was the thing that, you know, we joked about it already, you know, it was like, put down the gun. But, you know, there is this sense that Swifties send death threats or threaten people for daring to say that something by Hair Swift is not good.
Swift. Oh, my God. I just want to say before we get into it, like, all of my favorite artists that I constantly am bringing up on the show, Madonna, Liz Phair, Alanis Morissette, Amy Mann, Joni Mitchell, whatever, they have all come up with some of my favorite music. The reason I'm, for instance, hosting a show like Keep It is because I love that music so much. Mm-hmm. All of those people have also come up with some of my least favorite music that I own.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying? Like, being a fan of somebody, I think you should have an enhanced sense of what they are able to do, and that should make you able to criticize them even more and even further. It shouldn't be, I'm afraid to engage with the idea that they gave less than an A-plus effort, you know? I think actually one of the reassuring things about life is that everybody is capable of being bad. You know, like, Bob Dylan has bad albums. Bruce Springsteen has bad albums. I don't care about The Ghost of Tom Joad. I don't care about The Grapes of Wrath that much. You know what I'm saying?
How many times have I, on this show, as more than a card-carrying member of the Beehive, like, I'm an enforcer at this point, you know? I shoot people who aren't listening to Cowboy Carter enough. How many times have I said that I hate I Am Sasha Fierce? And it's also an album that feels overstuffed. Like this, there are a lot of things I love about I Am Sasha Fierce. I mean, Diva is on that album, you know? And it is also just kind of a mess and a collection of songs. And I don't know. I fucking love The Strokes. And have they released a good album in years? I'm wearing an Arctic Monkeys shirt, okay? But the funny thing about the sort of like Taylor Swift ecosphere is the fact that so many of her fans, and I guess, listen, when you do love an artist so much and you relate to her, you do sort of get defensive of, like, things that you love. But there's just been sort of this parasocial relationship that has been built up so much to the point where any criticism of her feels like an affront to you. And so there's always this defensiveness of, you can't say that the music is bad. You can't say that you don't like something because it is what? It's anti-feminist, it's misogynistic, it's, you know, there are obviously people who hate Taylor Swift and talk about hating her a lot online in very gross ways, you know, that are awful. But there's always this conflation of that with any valid critique of her music.
Yeah. I also think in general, like, the fandom of Taylor Swift, it's a little bit more like being a fan of a book series or something, where she creates kind of a world they like being in. You know how it's like, even in the past few albums, actually going back to 1989, there is this kind of comforting, enchanted awe to everything. There's like moody sense to everything. There's literally a calming effect to the world she brings. And I feel like that's that thing she does, even though there are personal lyrics and you do, I guess, learn about her through these songs, I really think even her biggest fans know she's kind of playing a character, and these scenarios she's drawing out have sort of a literary vibe. And so it's more like being invested in something like Grey's Anatomy, where you're like, I've been involved with this thing for so long. I want to know where these characters go. You know, what's she going to say this time? You know, or like being a fan of a soap or something, to put it in your language.
I tweeted this when the album first dropped, you know? I said, this is like season fucking 16, 17 of Grey's Anatomy.
Oh, it's really?
Like,
yes.
It's like, okay, girl. I get what's going on at Seattle Grace, but Where's Bridgerton?
Yeah.
You right. know, like give us something different. And the soap opera thing is actually really interesting because my friend Angelina Burnett, who said she got to meet you at the Writers Guild
WGA Awards.
Where
I lost.
Yes. Sorry. But you knew that was going to happen.
No, right. This yeah. John Oliver keeps existing. It's so annoying.
She described it to me as the soap opera, too. She was like, it's very similar to the way that, well, me, but also our moms and our grandmothers would watch the same soap opera every day. And it is the exact sort of the exact same storylines happening day after day, year after year, decade after decade. I'm watching Days of Our Lives on Peacock this morning, and it is the same fight between Nicole and Kristen that has been happening for years. And there's a comfort, obviously, in knowing these characters and knowing where the stories are going. And, you know, it's sort of you can half pay attention to it. But, you know, there are sublime moments where either there's a really good piece of acting or a really fun piece of writing, or a storyline twist in a way that you weren't expecting that really sort of moves you, or a character comes back and revisits a very emotional story that you used to love, and it sort of really hooks you, you know? I'm not ever judging a Swiftie from, like, feeling emotional from listening to her music, you know? I've cried when a character dies on Days of Our Lives, you know? I get it. But I also do not feel vitriol for people who say Days of Our Lives is not top-tier television, because it's not Succession.
Right, right. I also think in terms of why this album is getting received less well, including by, I think, the both of us.
We're tired.
There's that. But also it's like the title of the Tortured Poets Department, she wants there to be an emphasis on the words themselves. And even the way she delivers it, that kind of conspiratorial, like, I'm whispering it to a friend or just a close group of people. Like, she's submitting it for the approval of the Midnight Society, right? Leaning into a group of people sitting around a fire. You know, when you're focusing that much on the lyrics and they're so in the vein of everything she's done before, and it's still about being this particular melancholic relationship with some guy who's, like, kind of a prick, and we're on the outs, and can we make it work, and I'm getting over him, and I'm also a ghost. I think there's just not enough new there to kind of get into the A range in terms of grading this album. You know what I mean? It just is too much a fixation on where we've been and the kinds of relationships she's already had. I didn't see much in the way of effort to have, like, to talk about a new topic. I kind of want to give Taylor Swift just a handful of things that have nothing to do with her previous albums. Please just talk about whatever. The continent of Australia. Go. I don't even know what you... Go say something. Say something new about this.
Can we play that improv game where we just shout out words and then she has to make a song?
Yeah, dang. I'm sure she'd be great at it, to be honest.
What does she think about tapioca pudding?
Yeah, I don't like it. My pudding should be smooth. That's my feeling.
Getting into the content of the album, what is going on with Florida? Because that is a new topic for her.
Yeah, that's
the
right.
Fortnite, the first song starts out with... she's playing a bit of a character here. She has a song with Post Malone. It's the lead single. The video is obviously inspired by Poor Things. She's friends with Emma Stone. And she recreates Poor Things with Post Malone. And I love Austin Post. So
lovely
this is
voice.
One of my favorites on it. It doesn't hit the heights, you know, not to do the Beyonce comparison. It doesn't hit the heights of Levi's Jeans.
Quite.
It's sort of very Snow on the Beach, the original version. There aren't a lot of Post Malone vocals going on.
And I just want to say, by the way, that the Lana comparisons with this album, I find unavoidable. Like, it is kind of going for a Lana Del Rey thing. Yes.
Mm-hmm. But she's kind of playing this character, you know, they're talking about being neighbors and, like, this sort of affair and imagining things. But there's this line, another Fortnite lost in America, move to Florida, buy the car you want. And then, of course, there's the song Florida, 3 exclamation points, with Florence and the Machine. And that's a new topic. And I'm wondering, what's going on with Florida?
Maybe that's the theme for the next album, because it is, I don't associate her with Florida in any way. And it's a fraught state here in 2024. So in my mind, this is controversial on her behalf. Can I just say, in terms of things Taylor Swift does that I'm a little sick of? Invoking things like curses and snakes and lightly paranormal things. You know how you can't stop talking about how you went to Tisch? It's kind of like she can't stop talking about how she went to Hogwarts. You know what I mean? It's like all in the universe of Harry Potter land somehow. It makes you feel like the whole thing is a little bit for like a Disney adult. You know, there's that sense of in her writing that this is always for people who are younger than she is, which is a savvy move. And she's, by the way, done that since, of course, on Fearless. She wrote a song at about 20 years old for people who are 15 as if she had just been there, which is so smart, right? Like, I was just there. Let me tell you how it went. I still feel like that's the permeating feel of a lot of her music.
It was a spell.
Yes.
Actually.
Yes.
And all and every Swiftie is 15. Yeah. Forever. there is this sort of arrested development that happens with the fan base. And it is sort of how it's ingenious, to be honest. You know, when you look at the Eras Tour, how huge that was. And there's always going to be new, younger fans who are getting into the music because of the themes. But then also the adults who continue to listen to it can always sort of feel like they have a safe place.
Yeah,
you know?
It's like you get this hall pass from adulthood through her music.
And obviously, you know, there's the snake stuff too, which is connected to Kim Kardashian and that entire reputation era. Her best album, by the way, for me, mostly because when you think about her maudlin lyrics, right? You sort of want to pair them with really fun, interesting production. And I think that the blend of Max Martin and then also Jack Antonoff doing some of his best work on Reputation is what makes it work. You have songs like Dancing With Our Hands Tied, Getaway Car. Like, these lyrics are fun, even Ready For It, you know, which is a Burton to his Taylor. Like she's funny and making interesting pop culture references on that album, you know? And there are really good lyrics on this album. There's just so much to sort of seep through. And I feel like my main problem with this album kind of really has nothing to do with her lyrics or her singing or the content, to be honest. I'm just really sick of Jack Antonoff's production.
Knowing he worked on it from the first since you hear, you kind of know what the whole album will be. And by the way, it's so much album. So additionally, I want to say on that front, you brought up Max Martin. My personal taste, I think Taylor Swift is at her best lyrically when she's writing to a tight hook. It forces her to be cleverer. And like then you remember the sentiment and it's way more damning. Whereas on this, I'm going to call the style of writing here doggerel. You know, it's like not, one line will be extremely long, the next will be short. You know, it's not metered the way a normal pop song is. That's a very particular type of writing that I think not many artists have excelled at. Like, I think of someone, I hate to invoke Joni Mitchell, because when people bring up Joni Mitchell in this conversation, you may as well say, well, Taylor Swift is no John Steinbeck. I mean, they have nothing in common. You know what I mean? It's like a completely different universe. And the instrumentation alone and how Joni wrote to those, like, her quote-unquote weird chords.
First of all, Reputation's better than Of Mice and Men, so she ate that.
Take that, George. Take that, Lenny. But I just like Blank Space, for example, off 1989. The melody is so punchy. And the lyrics, while talking to this guy, whoever it is, each little like synthy star in the music pops and makes you think about the situation and you're in it. And the drama is so enhanced. Whereas here, the way she's sort of sliding through these long, lugubrious sentences, very adverb heavy, doing the thing I also don't like she does, which like mixing too many cliches. Like even the song titles on half of this are like cliches that you'd see on the internet from the past 5 years. You know, I hate it here style lyrics. It all feels borrowed from the same word bank.
Yeah, he only breaks his favorite toys. But daddy, I love him.
Three different songs in this album take place on a playground to get back to the juvenilia of it all. Yeah.
I really like what you said about the Blank Space particularly, because this is gonna sound weird.
Go ahead.
But I think she's best when she's sort of a raptress. You know?
Interesting.
In the sense that the song Down Bad, which
I enjoy.
Yeah, chorus wise it feels very Reputation. It's just the succinctness of now I'm down bad crying at the gym.
Yes.
Everything comes out teenage petulant.
Acknowledging the petulance, yes, too. Good move. And then the fuck it if I can't have him. Like, that's, yes, memorable. Yeah.
When she is almost rapping, because, you know, when you rap, there is, you know, there is the, there's the count of the beat. There's like, you have to stay on it. You have to get these words out quickly. And it's why you love sort of rappers who are sort of verbose, you know, like a T.I. or like a Busta Rhymes or something, or like Nicki with her triple entendres and things, right? It's more memorable because you are fitting it within to the confines of the beat, the hook, etc. And when she has to stay in sort of a rigid framework, I think her music really excels. When she is just unspooling without an essay word count is where she loses me.
Right. I mean, I can only think of a few artists in history who, like, will squeeze in tons of extra syllables, and I think there's artistic merit to it. Like, I think a little bit of Alanis Morissette's second album, Supposed Former Infatuation Junkie, which is just an album filled with monologues. You know, Thank You, the song where she's naked in the video, that's as collected a pop song as you get on that album. Everything else is sort of monologue. And that's, I think, an album you have to acquire. If I'm a music critic listening to that on one or two listens, I'd probably be like, what did this fucking trip to India do to this woman? She's lost her goddamn mind. But it's something I've acquired over time. And I do have to say, again, I feel like this album will have legs in that way. You know, if there's that much material to absorb, I think over time you can only sort of get a little bit more of it with every listen. And so it can feel like appreciating something. But I just don't think there's enough topics on this album to really warrant, you know, a really enriching multiple listens.
When we're back, even more Taylor Swift, If You Could Believe It. Keep It is brought to you by Barefoot Dreams. Lewis?
Yes?
When you see footprints in the sand, that was when I carried you in my Barefoot Dreams robe.
Now, is that a Leona Lewis song? No?
If you want to bring coziness into your life, you turn to Barefoot Dreams, especially now as the brand is celebrating their 30th anniversary. With those 30 years of coziness, Barefoot Dreams celebrates being the originators of everyone's favorite luxe home blanket. And while many have attempted to duplicate their blankets, robes, and more, Barefoot Dreams' fabrication and quality cannot be replicated, so don't believe the dupes. Girl, this blanket is it.
I effing love this blanket. I'm thinking about it right now, and I want to jump in my bed, which is sponsored by something that we'll do another ad for momentarily. Get ready. There's a reason why Barefoot Dreams has been on Oprah's favorite things list 6 times. Jesus, get a life, Oprah. My God. Dressing head to toe in Barefoot Dreams is the key to comfort, as their collection of ultra-soft robes, loungewear, and accessories are made with premium materials. Their products make the perfect gifts, too. I throw this thing on. I wear it like a shawl. I look exactly like Ellen Burstyn. And I am the coziest a human being can be. Because, by the way, it's still that time in Los Angeles where it's like pretty mild outside and then your apartment is cold. I can't explain it. I don't know things like basic science. For Keep It listeners, you can get 15% off your first purchase at barefootdreams.com with the code KEEPIT15. Don't miss out on Barefoot Dreams' soft, soothing fabrics that will bring luxury to your life.
Keep It is brought to you by 3-Day Blinds. There's a better way to buy blinds and window treatments, and it's called 3-Day Blinds. Well, I really want to hear about this because the only blinds I know are at the poker table.
Oh, that, interesting, Annie Duke. I didn't know that about you. 3-Day Blinds are the leading manufacturer of custom window treatments in the U.S., and right now they are running a buy one, get one 50% off deal. Blinds are a huge part of my life. I need to sleep soundly, not just lightly. And the blinds in my house make me achieve this, along with my incredible mattress. I'll let you guys guess where it's from. But 3-Day Blinds, essential to the way I run my life. We can shop for almost anything at home. Why not shop for blinds at home, too? 3-Day Blinds has local, professionally trained design consultants who have an average of 10-plus years of experience that provide expert guidance on the right blinds for you and the comfort of your home. Just set up an appointment, and you'll get a free, no-obligation quote the same day.
Right now, you can get 3-Day Blinds. It's buy one, get one 50% off deal on custom blinds, shades, shutters, and drapery. For free, no charge, no obligation consultation, just head to 3dayblinds.com/keepit. That's buy one 50% off when you head to 3dayblinds.com/keepit. One last time, that's the number 3daybl.com/keepit. Black Stories, Black Truths is a celebration of blackness from NPR and how I live my life every day.
Oh, I'm glad to bear witness to it.
Each of NPR's black voices are as distinct, varied, and nuanced as the black experience itself. In the Black Stories, Black Truths collection, you'll hear stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and creating world-shifting things out of a struggle.
It sounds like you at Coachella. I'm already tuned in. Every episode is a living account about what it means to be black today, told from a unique black perspective, from Bobby Shmurda to The Wire, Michelle Obama to reparations. There's no limit to the range of Black Stories, Black Truths.
Black perspectives haven't always been centered in the telling of America's story. Now they are the story. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of some of NPR's best podcast episodes celebrating the black experience. Hear a feed of episodes from across NPR's podcasts that center black voices. It's NPR Noir. Turn on NPR today and hear a range of voices as very nuanced and black as the country we reflect. Stories should never be about us without us.
Doesn't the black experience sound like a 3-disc Prince album we never got? Someone check the vault, please. Listen now to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR, wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, what I will say topic-wise, what is interesting to me on the album is the fact that everyone was expecting this to be an anti-Joe Alwyn album.
Right.
And so much of it is actually about Matty Healy. And it's, of course, there's more to talk about from even a short relationship with the frontman of a rock band. You know, like that's going to instill shit to talk about within anybody. You know, famously throughout history, being screwed over by a male rocker has given many of our favorite artists shit to talk about.
We, in fact, get into this with Juliana Canfield. So look forward
yes.
to that.
Ignoring the juvenileness of But Daddy, I Love Him, the title, I find that song so fun and interesting because this is her sort of fighting back against the Swifties, in a sense. She's talking almost a bit like she's angry that they forced her to stop dating this guy who was probably, you know, giving her some of the best sex of her life.
Apparently, yes.
You know, and then she's joking about, but Daddy, I love him. I'm having his baby. No, I'm not, but you should see your faces. That's fucking funny.
Yeah, right. And a change up, like a kind of sardonic humor you don't normally hear from her either. I would love for her to dip further into a sort of mean-spirited humor. Again,
yeah.
If she dunks on the Swifties way more often, that's just going to play well with me. You know, because she knows the fan base. Again, the average person on the street, not even the average fan of Taylor Swift, the average person on the street is a Taylor Swift zealot. You know what
yeah.
I mean? If she walks down the street, she's running into somebody who has like violence in their eyes if they see her. They're so obsessed with her.
Okay, there's lawyers, Pharisees, and Swifties.
Now you're writing like Joni Mitchell.
I also really like the song So High School.
That has a hook in it, by the way, and I yes. love her vocal on it. I actually have to say, I think her vocals on this album are one of the best parts of it. Like, obviously, like, I think the X Factor of 1989 is the mix of the melancholy synths with her, what she's doing with her voice, that talky, again, conspiratorial thing that just meshes really well. It, of course, always reminds me of that song from the movie Drive. What's that by? Is it called College is the name of the band or whatever? I can't believe I can't remember that. But that, I think, is always a landmarky song that she's kind of referencing with what she does.
Yeah, I definitely get that when you talk about her voice, because obviously someone who becomes a very successful musician, obviously there's something you like about hearing them, you know? And there's just really something that what really digs into you about Taylor Swift is just like, I like her voice and I like the things that she does with it. And there's certain ways that she says lyrics or words that stick in your head. And that is why you enjoy listening to her. And I think that like I said, she's funny. I enjoy So High School lyric-wise, too. You know, I feel so high school every time I look at you, referencing, I'm watching American Pie with you on a Saturday night.
Too vivid.
And then also there's my favorite song on the album, I Look in People's Windows. And this is, thank God, a song that she made with Patrick Berger, a different producer, for once. And he's worked with Charlie XCX before. So, you know, I like the sound of it. And I also like the lyrics, just because, you know, there's only so many ways that you can describe a relationship that failed and thinking about it. But I like when she dips into her sort of like creepy weirdo persona and the lyrics of I look in people's windows in case you're at their table. What if your eyes looked up and met mine one more time? Like the image of this bitch walking through the streets of New York and peering in windows of the people who she knows her ex is friends with is voyeuristic. It's fun to me. Like, I like the weirdness of that song.
It reminds me of that image of Nicole Kidman walking down the street on surveillance footage in that show, The Undoing, yes, with Hugh Grant. And then she turns right to the camera in a creepy Blair Witch way. But speaking of Charlie's, as you said, XCX, how about the name drop of Charlie Puth on Tortured Poets Department, where, first of all, I think that's the worst lyrics on the album, just that whole song. It's a lot of, like fitting, like, chunky, like clauses and phrases into like what should otherwise be a very short stanza. It's like an attempt to sound interesting and instead it's just confusing. Anyway, but she says in the song, Charlie Puth should be a bigger artist. Now, if she wants to get on my side, standing Charlie Puth is exactly what she should be doing, because even after that last album, which we, you know, was up and down for us, and by up and down, I do mean down.
Loser was a highlight though.
Yes, I enjoy that. And Light Switch I enjoy. But, what do you think Charlie Puth felt about that?
I don't know, because he hasn't really responded to it yet either.
Yeah.
But that is, at first I was wondering, is this a diss? Or is it?
It does feel lightly shady. Like the world's biggest celebrity being like, oh, he should be a little bit bigger. You know?
Yeah. But also my response to it was, okay then. So Rocket.
Where's the feature?
Collab with him.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Okay? Because he is a really good pop songwriter, you know? And sometimes, you know, artists, like we said, like, get into their own head and sort of, like, lose the trees for the forest. Or is it forest for the trees? They're losing something. It's Fern Gully up in this bitch, okay? Like, the whole jungle, the whole rainforest is being raised. Me, as a huge Charlie Puth fan, you know, I've admitted, like, you know, the album, which I liked initially quite a bit, and maybe I liked it initially, you know, too, because that's, I also met him like around that album.
And was
interviewing him, you know, like there was something different that felt, there was a different sensation of how I consumed that album as opposed to how I consumed his other ones. But I haven't really revisited it, you know, and that's also a thing about acknowledging that some of your favorite artists aren't making music that sticks with you, or like sometimes they had a misstep, you know? But he does know how to write a pop hook, you know? And he's written so many fantastic pop songs that I think that, you know, a collaboration with Charlie would be fun to see Taylor work with him. Or, you know, bring back St. Vincent, too, because St. Vincent did Cruel Summer with her.
Right, which we cannot get off the fucking charts. Jesus Christ, I'm going to come there with like a scraper and try to like pull it off the Hot 100. I was blown away recently to learn that Tate McRae's Greedy is still like in the top 20. Girl, I was listening to that at Thanksgiving. Let's move this along.
I was shocked yesterday to discover that Hozier
is number one
song.
What? We left him at church.
He said, take me to church. And we're like, okay, but I got to go.
Yeah, right. My Uber's going this way, though. Yeah.
The last time I used Uber Share was to get Hozier to church.
He thanks you. I guess it worked out for him.
But this new song of his is, I guess my friend was like, it was blowing up on TikTok, you know, which is what
Ain't
you can assume
way.
when anything is hitting the charts. But this TikTok shit is no joke. Okay. I played this song And I was like, okay, it's fine. I'm probably never going to listen to it again in my life. And then I'm, you know, looking at other shit on my phone, what have you. I realized the song's been playing for like maybe 30 times, half an hour. I didn't stop it. It just got stuck in my brain. And I liked the repetitiveness of it. And I didn't press stop. I didn't even notice it was still playing.
You know, a song that's still huge that is the same thing for me is that Jack Harlow song, Lovin' on Me. Like, you start playing that, oh, I'm walking through Target. Oops, I'm going to play it 46 times because it's only a minute and 8 seconds or whatever.
You know what got me off of that song? Seeing, like, wiggas on TikTok.
My favorite word from my when I was 11 years old. My favorite, I mean, not my favorite, but
seeing them make TikTok videos trying to be sexy to that Jack Harlow song, I was like, maybe I thought I had a thing for white boys. Maybe I don't.
Yeah, that's over now. Thank God. Call Taylor. The curse is lifted.
They call me white man's enemy after that. Okay.
I should say, by the way, that Charlie Puth, among the many great songs he's written, is the very underrated Small Talk by Katy Perry. One of my favorite singles of her. That's very like low octane. Like it's not going for the mammoth heights of Teenage Dream or California Girls. Such a good song, though.
Much better, though, is Harley's in Hawaii, which he also did. And can you imagine? First of all, that song is so fucking good, to be honest. And can you imagine if Taylor had done Harley's in Hawaii?
Oh, what an unusual choice that'd be for her.
That'd be as big as Cruel Summer, though.
That's
it's
true.
Cruel Summer-esque.
By the way, Katy Perry will be coming back to haunt you this episode during my Keep It, so we can put a pin in that for now.
Speaking of Katy Perry, though, another reason that Taylor was sort of so interesting around that 1989 Reputation era, I'm sorry to say, pitting women against each other, was all the shit and the feud with Katy Perry, because it was a diversion from her usual topic of singing about ex-boyfriends. You know, there was something else going on. There was anger at someone. There was a beef. There was, you know, something that people could direct their attention to. And I'm like, who else is going to piss off Taylor? Okay. Kanye and Katy lost. Who else is going to do it?
By the way, can I just say, nothing upsets me more than when people use the verbiage or rhetoric, stop pitting women against each other. It always feels to me like stans being like, stop bringing up other artists. It's like, just because you haven't heard of anybody doesn't mean we haven't. Sorry.
Okay.
I listen to music because it fits into a collage of what I've already listened to before. It's necessary for me to compare it to other music, so I have the words to describe it, basically. So if all that's in your universe is one artist, again, it's probably you who has the problem. And again, these are the people who are always like, they're lashing out at some writer. Somebody who wrote the review for the Washington Post said this, like, I'm a middle-aged man. Like, you know, you say this isn't for me. Who cares about my opinion? When it's like, no, I don't care about a stan's opinion. You have to like it for whatever fucking reason you think you need to like it, and then spread it around as if it's gospel when it has nothing to do with reality because you think this is like your best friend, Yolanda.
What does my mom have to do with this?
I was referring to Saldivar, but okay.
My mother also tried to shoot me.
Yeah.
Also, I really hate when people try to level that at gay men, or like even especially us here, right? You're pitting two women against each other. Would you do that to a man? First of all we do is pit men against each other.
It's called sports. I mean, literally everything we do is we love how men are pitted against each other. Every movie is about men pitted against each other.
All we do is pit hot men against each other online all day.
Right. Yeah. What do you want them to do? Lay around statically? No, action is exciting.
I am switching back between two OnlyFans pages in the middle of the night, okay? Someone's going to win.
I did not mean to divert us here. Write the letters to that side of the screen. Okay, yeah.
There is just something about beef, okay? And I want to talk about a bubbling. Like, I don't know if it's beef, but I think the girls should be paying more attention to Kim Petras and Slater.
What's happening
there?
Because, first of all, they diverted from the same chromosome. They burst out of the same manic panic hair dyed womb.
Of course. Do you remember that Slater was supposed to be releasing a Miami-based project? She was teasing it.
Ah.
And then Slump Pop Miami came out. And then now we haven't heard the Slater project.
That's very strange, especially since I don't feel like anybody's really looking out for Slump Pop Miami. So you can just go ahead and put out that Miami project.
Baby Kim wasn't looking for it.
Those songs, I mean, and again, calling them songs is generous. What they are, she is certainly horny. I said Andrew WK is to partying, she is to gay sex. Like, the song titles are like, gay sex now, more gay sex, anal, rimming.
She's my browser history, yeah. Basically.
Oh, God.
Can you...
Typing that right into Google? That's too bad. Yeah.
Yeah, listen, I mean, she is the Mae West of our time.
Sure,
you know?
All right.
Are you ready for a rim job? Is basically, why don't you come up and see me sometime?
Okay. Why don't you come up and see me in my third eye, if you know what I mean? Let's talk about this Kim song for a moment, which is called Thank You, Amy. First of all, Amy is Britney Spears culture. If you're going to bring up Amy in a song title, you're tangling with that. First of all, this is a differently spelled Amy, but notably in the title, K, I, and M are capitalized because she wants her fans to be what they are, which is the world's dumbest detectives who need everything spelled out for them. You know that Snowman movie, like, I gave you all the clues? She's literally like, I'm giving you the clues.
I mean, they're sort of like the number 79 ladies detective agency.
They're like in Botswana, but like nearly unemployed. They met Jill Scott once.
Screamed, fuck you, Amy, to the night sky as the blood was gushing, but I can't forget the way you made me heal, and it wasn't a fair fight or a clean kill each time that Amy stomped across my grave. And then she wrote headlines in the local paper, laughing at each baby step I take. And it was always the same searing pain. Like, is this the La Llorona story?
Yeah. Yeah, none of those lyrics. It's all like melodrama and like stomping on graves. And it's just, it just, she's been doing that for 10, 15 years. I have to say about Taylor Swift, I am curious what she does in the next 5 years. These lyrical references are so embedded in teenagerdom and in childhood in a way where it's just, I you could do that for the rest of your career, but I'm just curious what she will sound like in 5 years. I think that's, I think it has is yet to be told what her world of lyricism will sound like.
Also, one thing about this song is she's a liar. So I changed your name and any real defining clues, and one day your kid comes home singing a song that only us two is going to know is about you, because all the time you were throwing punches, it was all for nothing. First of all, anytime you write a song that's about Kim, your fans are going to know, okay? Kim will know it's about her.
Yeah, there's definitely no such thing as a song that only she knows is about somebody, right? Like, there's too many people on the case. People who are in the two or three ladies detective agencies are also available and decoding things.
I like when she's petty, though. Like, it's fun.
Petty is like a legit personality trait. Like, some of these things, it just feels like inventing a character as opposed to expressing a real personality. So when you get into pettiness, I'm thinking, oh, I might actually be getting to know her a little bit here.
Right. Why have the lie? Like, you don't have to lie to kick it here, Taylor. Like, just actually say, remember when you dragged me with your husband, who you're now divorced from? And now also, North sings my songs, bitch.
Yeah.
That hits.
It is very unusual that she just capitalized the words. Like, what? I guess that gets you a headline or something. It feels very on the nose and strange.
It looks like an aim away message.
It sure does. Also, if you want to drag Kim, please just use footage of her in the new AHS series. Oh my God. Why does she get to do this? I saw some scene where she's digging a nail into somebody's neck and, like, you know, trying to read him for filth. Woof. Let's get Lee Strasberg on the phone. I'm not seeing much in the way of the method here. The acting was not hitting.
I mean, all you have to do is play clips of Kim K's acting in Temptation, Confessions of a Marriage Counselor, that Tyler Perry movie.
And by the way, then, of course, she could clap back at Taylor if she releases an album of her own and then use footage of her in The Giver or whatever, The Lorax. I have to say, the funniest thing about Taylor Swift is the filmography. Like, that it goes from Valentine's Day to Amsterdam. Everything is, like, lightly floppy in a new direction. Never not funny.
Honestly, that's a pretty good idea because I have been waiting for the album for a very long time. How do you release Jam as a lead single and then don't follow up with the rest of the album?
Yes. Strange.
Come on, Kim. I'm still playing your Jam.
Okay. So yeah, overall, I have to say something I am very grateful for with this album is it did make me think, wow, I gave Cowboy Carter too low a rating because it's better than this.
Well, also that has, and maybe this will stick with me too, but I actually can't stop listening to Cowboy Carter. And I think I rated it a B.
Yeah.
When we reviewed it, and right now I'd kind of give it an A minus.
I think I'm going to give this Taylor Swift album, and I would have given it a lower grade before, I'm going to give it a C.
Yeah. I think it's around a C plus for me.
Yes. She's one of the definitive album artists of her time. It's actually kind of rare she would have an album that I would rate this low, honestly, even though I'm not a stan.
It is a misstep, but it is more interesting to me than Midnights. Midnights, I really thought, was a sort of Craven thrown out cash grab to just be releasing a new album in the midst of the Eras tour.
Yeah. I feel like Midnights was a whisper in the night, and this is a long angry poem in the middle of the night, which at least I can hear you better.
Yeah, I can hear the scribbling on the parchment. That table is shaking.
By the way, she also brings up ink too much. Girl, you don't have a quill. Sorry. I'm not seeing you buying a Bic even.
She's never even seen quills. I know she's not a Jeffrey Rush fan.
Now you're on our territory, bitch.
When we're back, Julietta Canfield. You know this week's guest from shows like The Calling, Why the Last Man, and of course, Succession. But what you might not know is she can turn it on stage just as well as the screen. Here to talk about her role in the new Fleetwood Mac-esque play, Stereophonic, welcome to Keep It, Julietta Canfield.
Thank you. Thanks, Ira. Thanks, Lewis.
Hi.
When I read about this play, I simply cannot believe it. It makes no sense to me that this has happened where everybody in this cast was not musically educated, and now suddenly they are the like toast of musical Broadway. So in putting together this play about a Fleetwood Mac-esque band, like, can you just talk about how daunting it was? It just seems impossible. It's like I don't sing and then suddenly I'm the best singer on Broadway. It makes no sense.
Yeah, it really doesn't make any sense. It was so not on my vision board to be singing on Broadway. I love to sing in the shower. I love to sing when I'm walking down the street when I think no one's listening. But the idea of singing in front of an audience of more than zero really, until last summer, sent me into a complete tailspin. So much so that I almost didn't even audition for the play because I was so nervous about showing how I could sing or like what my level of singing ability was. So I put off and put off and put off taping a song, I think for about a month, until I finally got a call from my agent and she said, listen, they really want to hear the singing. And if you have any interest in doing the play, just grab life by the horns and do it. And that was a long, lonely day in my apartment. I think it took me like 80 takes before I felt like I could send something in. But then, you know, exposure therapy is amazing. And in the beginning of rehearsal, we would rehearse as a band for most of the day. Usually a rehearsal day for a play is like 8 hours long. And we were spending 4 or 5 of those hours playing music. And so over time, my nerves just got worn down. There's only so long you can retain like an adrenaline state when you're doing something over and over again. I didn't even mention the piano, which was like a whole other thing. And doing singing and piano at the same time and trying to play as a band. I mean, when I describe it, it does seem kind of impossible to me. I don't really know how we did it.
What's so exciting about this play, you know, we already said, you know, it's like this Fleetwood Mac-esque band. They're recording an album in California when it starts. And then over the course of the play, they've been there forever. You know, it's sort of like No Exit.
Yeah. It starts in California and it ends in hell.
It really is. And it's like all of you are going through all of this turmoil in this. Can you talk about the rehearsal process of even creating it, you know, sort of with David Ajemi, the playwright, and then Will Butler, who did the music from Arcade Fire? Were Were there songs created when you first got the play? Did Will create the songs sort of as the play was going on? Were there things added? Were there things cut?
Yeah, so Will and David have been working on this play for a decade, pretty much. Mm. And the songs have gone through many iterations, but the ones you see in the play pretty much existed as they do in the play when we started rehearsal. There was no like sheet music or anything, but we had demos of Will playing all the instruments and singing. He's kind of like Peter in that he is a musical genius, but he's very unlike Peter because he's the sweetest, most patient and generous man alive. But what did happen when we got into rehearsal is that they, you know, we all auditioned for the play as individuals. And when we got into the room, we suddenly had to be a credible hit band. And so Will and our music director, Justin, who is also an incredible musician and such a patient leader, kind of honed in on each of our strengths as musicians and helped pull out the things that would make us feel strong and special as a musical group. So, you know, they had to hear all of our voices and then decide, okay, how are the harmonies going to go? And what do you think would be a good harmony here? And, you know, Tom has a very incredible, unusual falsetto. So it's like, let's send Peter up on those high parts and Juliana, you go up on the high part here and let's make the harmonies really crunchy along here. And as we got more comfortable on our instruments, Justin would come in and say, oh, could you play this little riff on the piano at this moment in the song? And so we built it incrementally and they built it kind of for us, but we had the skeleton of it from the start.
Did this process sort of force you to reacquaint yourself with music of the 70s? Did you find yourself revisiting old music in order to, I don't know about emulate the sound, but get the feel of that era?
Totally. I've always loved music from the 70s. I think before I did this play, Fleetwood Mac was like my most listened to band in 2023 or 2022.
Come on, taste.
Come on, taste. Yeah. Come on, classic
big old
rock
fuck
girl.
Yeah.
I know, it's a little humble brag. I just made a playlist where I put on a radio station that was all 70s music, and I've sort of was introduced to some musical artists who I hadn't really known about before, or wasn't conscious of, like Joan Armatrading, who's so incredible.
Love and Affection, great song, yes.
Oof, so good. And Won't You Come On Home? I mean, like there, and Joni Mitchell, I listened to so much before, but she was just back on the playlist in a major way. And yeah, it did feel important to me to listen to the quality of the music that they were making and the quality of their singing, which I think is so different from like a contemporary pop or rock sound. And it was just a nice reminder too, that there's so much like gritty imperfection in music from that time and so much raw emotion that comes through in every crack. And you can just hear the packs of cigarettes that they were all smoking. And that was this incredible, that gave me such a sense of permission to combat my inner desire for perfection, because I think the music of the time wasn't an attempt to create something perfect. It was an attempt to create something real. And so that was, yeah, I was listening a lot to it.
I mean, that's sort of the theme of the show as well. You know, mm-hmm. if you can really sort of extrapolate, you know, what the message is once you get to the end, there's this whole sort of, you know, fight with Peter and the rest of the band about Peter wants perfection, you know, and he's constantly changing things. And then everyone else is just sort of like, we're artists, you know, things should be messy. Things
totally.
Shouldn't be perfect. And so I have to wonder, when you're doing a show night after night, and you know, I saw the show at Playwrights Horizons, and then I saw it last night on Broadway. Congrats on being on Broadway now. If you're doing this show constantly, how do you maintain, I guess, sort of a messiness, a rawness. Each night when it's just, it's in your blood at this point. You've done a full run of it, and now you're doing another run of it.
Totally. Well, it's so interesting you say that, because that does feel like the tension of the play, right? Perfection versus like soul or something like that. Dionysian versus Apollonian.
Okay, I'm back in school. Okay.
Never heard of them. The play feels so messy and slouchy. Like we're all just like draped on that stage and there's so much waiting around and like this sort of decadent sense of boredom and time never ending. But the paradox of it is that the play is like a corset. It is so tightly and specifically rendered. And so I think actually the play is such a satisfying container because we really have to be precise. It feels like playing a piece of music or like doing a very complicated dance routine. But the result, if we're very precise with it, is something that feels very loose. And so actually, the more we do it, I think the easier the precision feels and the more natural it feels. And so then the result feels more and more lived in. Mm-hmm. It's kind of lovely. In the beginning, when we were doing it at Playwrights, I think we all felt so stressed out and nervous about hitting these moments. And there's so much overlapping in the play. And David makes all these designations for lengths of silences, which we were like trying to figure out as a group, like what's a short pause? What's a regular pause? What's a long pause? What's a deadening silence? What's a deathly pause? You know, all these things. And we were trying to figure out what the timing and the rhythm of the play was. And now that we've lived it more, it just feels easier and easier to be specific. And so then it feels easier and easier to just live in it.
Beautifully done, by the way, because I have to say, this is a 3-hour play.
This is a 3-hour play.
Whenever I tell people that, they're always like, girl, what? And I'm like, babe, I said that before I saw it. And then I was like, at intermission the first time, I was like, I'm loving this. My friend Brendan Holder, a writer, like texted me during intermission when he saw it last week. Mm-hmm. He was worried, 3-hour play. He sent me like during intermission, Stereophonic is turning it. I'm obsessed.
It's turning
you
it.
You know? And it's talking about those musical pauses and things. It's just, I can't believe that it is a 3-hour play that also has pauses and like silence built into it so much. And I'm not restless. I told you last night that I saw, like, I haven't been in a play in so long that during intermission, all you hear people talking about in the bathroom line are things. It's just like, I fucking love this play. So, I mean, congrats. And I have to ask, when you were on Succession, obviously that became such a behemoth. Like, it became so popular. And what's it like now? I mean, being on a show like that and seeing it grow into this thing, and now Stereophonic is also growing into that. I mean, it was sold out at Playwrights. It's basically selling out on Broadway. People are like, I want to see it, but I'm like, how can I get tickets? It's a thing already.
Yeah, it's so, I kind of can't believe it to have finished that job, which felt like the defining structure and energy source in my life for 5 years, basically. I thought I would end that and sort of fall into an endless depression and that nothing or no job could ever fill the void that Succession left behind. And I like, we wrapped that show, we had the premiere, and then I think within a month I was cast in this play. And I was like, okay, well, this will really keep me busy. It's a 3-hour play, as you say. I have to learn how to play the piano. I have to learn how to do a British accent. I have to make sure my vocal cords are in good shape. So I this will really keep me busy. And then through the rehearsal process, I was feeling so engaged creatively and so challenged creatively. And then we opened and it turned into this event. And I kind of don't know how my timing is quite impeccable, you know, like to go from Succession, which felt so big, And then to just leap into this other thing, which feels really big in a different way, but that's like as fulfilling, maybe more fulfilling. It's grand. It's a dream.
I feel like Succession is this rare show where, I mean, not only is it beloved, but truly every episode, everybody on that show seems to be giving the performance of their careers. Like there's always an element of tragedy in what's happening on screen and then mm-hmm. also hard comedy. So you get like totally. Both of these extremes every episode from most characters. So
totally.
Is there a particular scene you remember where you feel like everybody was working on all cylinders, including you, and the stakes felt high and you watch it back and you're like, yes, we nailed it. That was exactly what I had intended.
Well, you know, Jess is like such a sweet little fly on the wall in that show. So I feel like whatever you see of me is me responding to truly virtuosic performances and interpretations of brilliant writing. I will say that funeral scene in the last season, that day was so magnificent. And being in that church, they had four cameras rolling all the time. And there was so much text. And it was so moving because it was, spoiler alert, Logan's funeral. For those of you who haven't watched yet, sorry.
They should be onto that by now.
Yeah, I think the moratorium period is over. But it was also like a memorial service for the show in a way. I felt like we were all saying goodbye to this magnificent world that we'd been living in and we're getting ready to say goodbye to it. And so that day had a lot of that those days felt very impactful and wonderful. I'm in the very back row. You really don't see much of me, but if you had, Jess would be crying.
It's so exciting, probably for you as well, that like you left Succession and then you have this bond with Jeremy Strong that you've built, you know, throughout 5 years of the show. And yeah. Now it's crazy. Like he's what, a couple blocks from you now,
totally.
Doing Enemy of the People at
totally.
The same time.
I know. And then Natalie Gold is an appropriate. Mm-hmm. Across the pond.
She's very good. If I haven't said that on this show yet, it was such a pleasure to watch.
Oh, I know. And she's so excellent in it. She's always so good. I mean, yeah, the tragedy of being in a play actually is that you can see so little theater.
Yeah.
So during rehearsal, I was really stuffing in my theater nights as best I could. And so I did see Appropriate and I did see Enemy of the People. But yeah, it's just, it's lovely. It feels like this web, this continuum, like Succession is over, but then we all just get scattered into the wind like dandelion seeds and we get to go be a part of other things. And there's this little connection that remains among us. It's very lovely.
What is the schedule, by the way, though? Because, I mean, I think that, like, you have a Monday night show, which is great
yeah.
because so many theater people get to see it. But
know,
do you
so
have
nice.
Weekend shows or?
Yeah. So it's a little, we're a little bit in, we're not quite settled into the final version of the schedule yet. But we do two shows on Wednesday, two shows on Saturday, and then shows Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday. Mm-hmm. So for now, we have Sunday off. Eventually, we'll have Monday off. But it's eight shows a week. I spend one full day of the week doing the play because the play is 3 hours. So it's 24 hours of stereophonic per week, which is horrifying.
It's just scary to be a Broadway actor. My God, it's so daunting. Yeah.
But, you know, it's so funny because yesterday was our first day back after the day off. And I've definitely been in shows before where after the day off, I am dragging my feet to that theater. I don't want to restart the engine. But I woke up yesterday and I was like, oh, goody. I got to do it again. How great. let's go. And I got to the theater and I'm so excited to put on my little costume. Like the whole thing just is so engaging and energizing. And I'm the kind of, I like love to take a nap and lounge around. But this play feels like a recharge in a really unbelievable way.
I'm going to advise people to get tickets now because it's going to be impossible. This is like going to be the sensation of Broadway. And my final question to you is, and I believe this is an important telling personal question, in the way that people value the Zodiac and what their sign is, I think something that's more important is, what is your favorite Fleetwood Mac song? Because it's so telling of who you are and what you value in the group. I'm a You Make Loving Fun person because I run Christine. Yes.
Well, I love Christine too, and I love You Make Loving Fun.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
It's so great. And it's also, I love that it's about her affair with
the lighting,
the lighting designer.
Fuck yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Such a fuck you to John McVie.
Ding.
Love. I love Songbird.
You kept it in the Christine family. You may stay here on Keep It. Yes.
Keep it in the keep it in the Christine family. Yeah, that song, it's so beautiful. And I love it. It's the only song on that album that wasn't recorded in the studio. It was recorded in like a big music hall. And so you can hear, I feel like all of this, you can hear all of the space around the song. You can just hear her heart breaking. And I can just imagine, I mean, I can't imagine what it must, I mean, I guess I can kind of imagine what it's like to be in a band with your husband / ex-husband, but it ain't easy.
We keep it very Christine over there. Stevie for me, because you know mine is Gypsy Lewis.
As I fine song. Yeah, yeah. A fine song.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know, it respectable answer, Ira. Respectable answer.
Okay, Lewis and I talked about this on the show before. Did you know when you were listening to Gypsy that when she's like talking about, here I go, like to the Velvet Underground, that she's actually just talking about like a store that used to be in New York, like a store to like go to?
No.
It literally was called the Velvet Underground. I was like interpreting this lyrically. It was some mystical. You know.
I know, but that's what we always do. You know, it's like rock stars, like they don't go to stores. They just like live in a Velvet Underground tomb. Like, and then it's like, no, we're just going to a store and we're like buying gloves like another random girl in 77.
That's a very sort of like specific read about like revisiting music from, you know, 70s, 80s, et cetera. You know, you think about it when you're reading Shakespeare. You know, when you talk about theater, you know, it's like, oh, these words meant something, like they were actual references. And it's, you listen to some songs from like the 70s and 80s, and they're not all metaphor. They're literally just like current pop songs. They're like, oh, that was the Starbucks that they went to. Totally. It's the name of a coffee
Velvet
shop.
Velvet Underground is their Starbucks. And one day people are going to be like, wow, Taylor Swift was in a place called Starbucks.
Yeah.
Where you had to be a star to go.
Actually, in the future, we'll all be living there and forced to produce our albums. So,
right. Okay, well, that's true. Exactly.
Chairman Swift is coming.
Juliana, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much, Lewis.
And congrats to you on not just Succession, of course, but this just unreal show that everybody's going to be so thrilled to see.
Oh, thank you.
Like, you know what's coming for the Tonys. You know, like, it's coming, girl. And
from your lips to God's ears, my friend.
Then the show will be a bonanza. So
I hope.
I'm happy to be a stereophoner. We're coming up with a better name.
Okay, yeah, let's workshop that. That was good. We could do better than stereophoner, but we'll get there.
Jump into the world of Wild Kratts at Philadelphia's Please Touch Museum. Explore the world of this PBS Kids series in the Wild Kratts Creature Power Museum exhibit, opening May 31st. Discover animal habits from around the world as you swing through the trees like a spider monkey, sneak through the forest like a jaguar, hunt for lunch like a platypus, and much more in this adventurous new exhibit. Get tickets at pleasetouchmuseum.org. That's pleasetouchmuseum.org.
With chocolate treats mixed into dark chocolate ice cream, the Tillamook Chocolate Collection is a chocolate game changer. Because the thing that pairs best with chocolate is more chocolate. Tillamook Chocolate Collection Ice Cream. Extraordinary dairy.
I live by routines, but I especially love my same-day delivery routine with Shipt. And my shopper knows this about me. When Sunday rolls around and I place my weekly stock-up order, Joe sends texts from the aisles. Wilted lettuce? Nuh-uh. Hard pass. Deal on my favorite sparkling water? Whew. Grab two. Fresh flowers just because? Sounds like a delightful idea. If you love routines that work for you, get Shipt same-day delivery. Shipt. Delight in every delivery. Learn more at Shipt.com/hi.
And we are back with our favorite segment of the episode. It's Keep It. Lewis?
Yes?
You teased us already in the episode that your Keep It is about Katy Perry.
Yes, correct. Well, first of all, I was saying to Ira over the break, it's always interesting to remember that Katy Perry must be one of the richest people in entertainment. She's got the American Idol contract, which is untold millions of dollars. And then she's got that residency, which was so successful. Anyway, she posted a picture on Twitter where it's her in front of one of those fucking weird super Lego looking cars from Tesla. And she says, thanks for the delivery at Elon Musk. Hashtag Idol. Why every 6 months does she have to post something that's like, are you the dumbest fucking person I've ever met? Why? You're like boasting over a relationship with Elon Musk? Like how like detached from reality or like, yeah, reality's the word. Can you think that's like a rad flex or something? I'm so puzzled by that.
I mean, Grimes even hid the fact that she had another child with that man for a very long time.
We've been through that news cycle. Yeah.
Yeah. It was... She looks great in the photo, by the way.
Jesus Christ, does she look great. Oh, my gosh. I mean, like, the vamp of your dreams. Jessica Rabbit, the house down, meow.
What?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Wait, Rue?
Yeah.
I have another lipstick and another joke. Now, she looks great, and she's been teasing KP6, yeah. And I am excited for it.
Me too, yeah.
Unfortunately, the reason I'm excited for it is because I know that it will have nothing but banger pop hooks because she did allegedly go and get a prescription pad for this album.
Meaning?
She's back with the doctor.
What? Oh, no. Well, he had to go somewhere. You know, he's operating out of his van these days, right? Yeah. He has like a pot of peyote.
He did lose his license.
Yeah,
so,
right.
Yeah.
You forget that he's around. But I mean, like, by the way, the story of there was a really long read about like the Kesha Dr. Luke situation that happened like a year ago or so that I feel like went totally under the radar. And it's a completely fascinating investigation of that. I don't even remember what outlet it was for.
Yeah. But anyway, KP6 is coming. And I don't know. Good luck.
I you know what I realized recently? She now is the age of Paula Abdul when she started on American Idol. And it has been the same amount of time from when... So when Paula started on Idol to the last time she had a number one hit is the same amount of time since Katy Perry has had a number one hit, which I think is like 12 years. Yeah, or yeah, 11 or 12 years because Paula's last number one is, I think, Promise of a New Day in 91. And then she was on Idol in 2002.
Dance Like There's No Tomorrow?
No, Dance Like There's No Tomorrow did not chart. Actually, it was barred from the chart. It actually went right to Guantanamo. I actually fucking love that song. I do not mean to hate on Dance Like There's No Tomorrow.
Great album cover.
Yes. Also, Paul always looks sensational. I mean, she's 1'7". It's like fully Jiminy Cricket.
Yeah. All right, so...
Ira, what's your keep it?
Well, to take us back to that era of American Idol, my keep it this week goes to... people who need to leave a particular joke alone because I'm tired of it.
Okay.
So Retro News Now posted the Billboard Hot 100 for the week ending April 20th, 2002.
Okay.
Other than just basically making me cry because music isn't like this anymore and videos aren't like this anymore. And it's like all 10 songs on this chart I listen to constantly, even a fucking Puddle of Mud song, Blurry. Like, I liked Puddle of Mud at one point.
I just want to say that I also love the term butt rock, which is used to describe things like puddle of rock. Whoever coined that, hats off. It makes me laugh every time.
But the top three songs on the chart that week are Foolish by Ashanti.
Mm.
What's Love, Fat Joe featuring Ashanti.
Can I make a confession? I think What's Love is better than the song What's Love Got to Do with It. I would much sooner put on What's Love.
Well, there are less punches thrown in the studio.
Well, this is the solo era, so maybe there were less. Mm. Yeah.
Ain't It Funny.
J-Lo.
By J-Lo featuring Ja Rule. Now, obviously, we know the whole thing about Ashanti doing backup vocals on J-Lo's songs. And the internet is always making this joke about how, you know, she Ursula'd Ashanti, basically, like, used her voice, etc. This was posted, and if you look in the responses, and I'm not just talking about strangers on the internet, I'm talking about friends of mine, too, responding or commenting on it. The exact same joke about Ashanti and her top three singles charting. Oh, wow, look at Ashanti with the top three songs on the Hot 100. The joke is funny if you're the first person to tweet it. This was posted 2 days ago, and people are still making the exact same joke. And let me tell you, I don't mind J-Lo getting whacked a little bit. You know, she's a Leo. She could take it. We do deserve to have our narcissism thrown back at our face sometimes.
This is, in fact, what This Is Me Now is about. Yes.
Yes. But aren't y'all tired of the same fucking joke?
The point of a joke is you haven't heard it before. I'm sorry. There's something on the internet. There's a particular cabal of faggots who, when they post a joke, I know they're posting it specifically because it will get retweeted a lot. And the audience for the joke is people who have not yet seen it on Twitter. I know they are purposely posting it because they're rounding up the scraps of people who haven't been exposed to this already cliched thing. I just want to say to those people, and I don't want to name them because the names are in my head right now and I'm going to get in trouble.
Mm. Name them.
I fucking hate you. I fucking hate this. The point of writing is you should want to write something new. I don't know what Elon can do here. I know I was just talking about how he's horrible. Maybe he can help.
Mm.
What can you do to kill these gay people? Because I don't want to see it. And you want them dead and I want them dead. We can work together.
Hide the Discovy.
Yeah. Dang.
There's not even just that particular thing about jokes, too. I think we've said this before, obviously. I mean, we repeat ourselves, too. So we're the problem.
Right.
It's me.
don't do that song to me. Go ahead.
But there's also this thing of repeating a joke that, you know, like, we know is funny. And then sort of like repeating it at a party or repeating it online and expecting people to laugh. And it's basically the same as a straight man quoting Anchorman.
Right.
And you know, it is, you're not particularly funny yourself. You're repeating a funny thing.
Right.
And I'm laughing because I have the memory of it. But don't get it twisted. You yourself are not funny. And we've always had this sort of stereotype that, you know, gay men are funny, like they're very humorous, you know? But I feel like the internet has really proven that that is not accurate because many of them just repeat funny things that they've heard.
Yes, right. And
yes.
And just saying it in like the cadence that, you know what they'll do? They'll take a meme you've literally seen before, the picture, and then put with it some other word bank phrase you've seen before and put them, and that counts as a post, and they've come up with nothing other than putting the two things together, and now it's on Twitter and it gets to be theirs and they get all this attention for it. What happened to wit?
Well, I think Halle Berry's starring in it next week off Broadway.
I would love to see it. What? I'm there. Margaret Edson's like, are you sure? Okay.
Yeah. So we're getting Halle Berry and wit now. I want to see that, by the way. But I will credit the people who are good at it. You know? Like, I love a meme. You know? Like, I love a Whitney quote or something like that. But it takes a funny person to reference a meme in a way that makes you laugh. you know?
Or in a witty way, not just an obvious way, or in a palatably internet-ready way. Yeah.
I mean, I reference it all the time, and I know that, like, Bowen and Matt like love this particular quote too, and it's like it's always funny when one of them like is talking about like a certain song or something, and they do the you know, songs like that tell stories that people can identify with. Children were singing that song at graduations, weddings, funerals.
We really, I mean, I'll end this conversation on this. We have not gotten to the bottom of Whitney's quotability. I'm sure we will keep going back and finding moments. Why was she that funny? Again, it's like Betty Davis was never a writer. Why is she that funny? I think my answer in that case is she was an asshole. So, like, that makes you funny? But, like, Whitney, not really an asshole. Like, demanding and knows what she wants, but not... It's just she was so fucking funny.
Truly, there are always stories coming out from people who say that Whitney was the nicest person.
Yeah.
Was always advocating for people behind the scenes. I think there was an interview where she was talking about, you know, like working with Babyface on the Waiting to Exhale soundtrack, you know, and joking about like, make a list of like who you don't want on the album, you know, et cetera. But it's, she's like, of course she didn't do that. It's like she is thinking about people whose voices she loves and like who she wants. And, you know, I don't know. It's, she was a lovely person, and so that is always nice to hear.
That eternal clip of Natalie Cole winning that AMA, and she'd be like, this is the only time I've ever beaten her.
Yes, and pointing at each other.
Yes, so funny. Natalie Cole, also very funny. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I'm going to stick my neck out for that Naomi Ackie movie. I think it's underrated.
I Want to Dance with Somebody.
Yeah, with Stanley Tucci as Clive Davis.
It was a good movie. I enjoyed it.
Me too. I enjoyed it. Yeah.
It's probably better than this Back to Black shit.
You know what? I'm just fucking confused about that movie. Like,
okay,
it looks like it's gonna be okay.
It was getting good reviews,
and then yes, and then it wasn't.
Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. More to come on that front.
All right, that's our episode.
And that better be the end of that fucking album. We did a conversation for y'all.
Oh wait, she just dropped 30 more songs.
Oh. I'm electrocuted.
All right. Thank you to Julietta Canfield for being here with us. And we'll see you next week. Don't forget to follow Crooked Media on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok.
You can also subscribe to Keep It on YouTube for access to full episodes and other exclusive content. And if you're as opinionated as we are, consider dropping us a review.
Keep It is a Crooked Media production. Our producers are CJ Siege Pokinghorn and Chris Lord. And our associate producer is Kennedy Hill. Our executive producers are Ira Madison III, Louis Vertel, and Kendra James.
Our digital team is Megan Patzel, Claudia Sheng, and Rachel Gajewski. This episode was recorded and mixed by Evan Sutton. Thank you to Matt DeGroat, David Tolles, Kyle Seglin, and Charlotte Landis for production support every week.
Jump into the world of Wild Kratts at Philadelphia's Please Touch Museum. Explore the world of this PBS Kids series in the Wild Kratts Creature Power Museum exhibit, opening May 31st. Discover animal habits from around the world as you swing through the trees like a spider monkey, sneak through the forest like a jaguar, hunt for lunch like a platypus, and much more in this adventurous new exhibit. Get tickets at pleasetouchmuseum.org. That's pleasetouchmuseum.org.
I live by routines, especially my same-day delivery routine with Shipt. Because when Sunday rolls around, I'm not scared. I got my shopper on the way with all my favorites. Shipt, delight in every delivery. Learn more at Shipt.com.